Part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2005 lecture series presents Iraq, From Sanctions to Occupation and Resistance by Tariq Ali, writer, journalist, and filmmaker, on Thursday, October 21st at 4 p.m. on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Melody, what good is music if it ain't possessing something sweet? Now it ain't the melody and it ain't the music. There's something else that makes this tune complete. Yes, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
You could say swing is the topic of this hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today is psychologist Kay Redfield Jamison. She's written extensively on moods and mood disorders and creativity. Her latest book is about exuberance. That is the title of the book, Exuberance, The Passion for Life. Louis Armstrong is among the people Jamison cites in her new book. She quotes Armstrong's biographer, Lawrence Berggreen, who wrote that Armstrong had a distinctly American brand of optimism and striving, but there was power and even an edge of anger to the laughter. It was a cosmic shout of defiance, a refusal to accept the status quo, and a determination to remake the world of his childhood and, by extension, the world at large as he believed it ought to be. Kay Redfield Jamison quoting Armstrong biographer Lawrence Berggreen in her new book, Exuberance, The Passion for Life. At the outset of the book, Jamison says, those inclined toward exuberance have enjoyed the benign neglect of my field. My colleagues and I have tended more to those in the darkness than to those in the light. We have given sorrow many words, but a passion for life, few. With this book, Jamison offers us a good look at joyousness, a thing that helps lead us to creativity and courage. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. If you're outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Kay Redfield Jamison is professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, as well as honorary professor of English at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Her previous books include An Unquiet Mind, A Memoir of Moods and Madness, Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide, and Touched with Fire, Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Jamison, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. Delighted to be with you.
What is exuberance, and why do you say it's essential to our existence?
Well, exuberance is an overflowing and effusiveness of high mood and high energy, and it's characterized by just an optimism and a looking forward and a passion. And one of the reasons I subtitled the book, The Passion for Life, is that it is very much about intense emotion and intense positive emotion. And I think it's vital because it helps people to be motivated to do different things, to explore, to take chances, to take risks. It propels people to new ideas and to act on those ideas with dispatch and to communicate those ideas because it's, of course, a highly contagious state.
Right, right. The first person you cite as an exuberant personality is Theodore Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. And John Muir, right.
And John Muir. Mm-hmm. And Roosevelt, he seems to, at least to some extent, absorbed a zest for living from his father.
Yes, he said that he owed it all his sense of joy of life to the joyousness of his father, who had made his childhood magical by his contagious sense of joy.
Yeah. Now here with this reference to his father, you know, one couldn't think that, well, Theodore Roosevelt's father provided him with an environment where life was to be lived to the fullest. But also one wonders if Theodore Roosevelt's father was, there's a genetic gift here.
Certainly both. I mean, we know that, for example, extroversion, which is a temperament that is closely related, probably the most studied closely related temperament to exuberance, is very heritable. It runs in families, genetic, so that if one twin, identical twin, is exuberant and is brought up in Wisconsin, another one's brought up in New York, they are both likely, if one of them has exuberance, the other one is likely to be exuberant by temperament as well.
Hmm.
But it's also true that obviously the environment is terribly important, both in encouraging it and saying it's really a valuable thing, you know, it's a great thing to have, it's a wonderful thing to have, or in making children feel very uncomfortable about being enthusiastic.
Yeah. Well, thinking of the environment, let's talk about the physical environment. And here at the outset of exuberance, you have John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt hiking together.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been quite a walk.
Yes.
You know, I wonder if I could have kept up with them.
Well, one can imagine, because they both were great talkers and very energetic walkers and, of course, raving enthusiasts. And so you can only imagine these two men who were in love with the wilderness and in love with the natural world in general, and in love with ideas and preservation, going at it in the Yosemite for 3 days. It, to me, it's this wonderful image of just exultant pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. You say much of our joy is in direct response to nature, and here
mm-hmm.
we have these two men hiking through Yosemite. And maybe you'd like to talk with us a bit about the connection between nature and joyfulness.
Well, when you think about it, that we evolve, like all mammals, like all animals for that matter, we evolve our senses in response to changes in the natural world in terms of light and the seasons. And one of the things that we know that there are obviously times of the year when energy is less needed and times of the year, like in spring and the summer, where you really need high energy and high mood to get things done. We're talking about harvesting, planting, you know, following the sun is a very important part of what we do as a species and all mammals and animals do. And so our great hymns of joy, our great responses to nature have always been a direct result of our response to physical changes in our environment.
Hmm. Yeah, thinking of all the music that we have that deals with sun and sunshine.
Yes, very much so, and light and
light.
The great poetry and as well as music. And if you look at the Psalms, for example, or the hymns, again, you see people responding with this incredible passion for changes in life when spring returns, a tendency to want to put in life in the middle of winter and to try and recapture some of the passion and life of spring in the winter months.
Hmm. The physical environment is important. What about interior spaces, home, school, workplace?
Well, certainly that too, and I think particularly, I suppose, I one of the things that is, I think, very concerning to a lot of teachers and a lot of psychologists is that a lot of what we do, again, as young mammals, is play. And it's very important that we play and explore the world and take chances and just bound about our glump, as Earl would have it. And in this day and age, we've really gotten rid of a lot of recess. We've put a premium on structuring children's lives with a lot of academics, very highly structured sports, highly structured art and music lessons and so forth. And I think that some of that great pleasure of just bounding about is at risk. If you're talking about interior space, the interior space of schools gets, I think, more and more structured as the years go by.
Yeah. Well, the lives of children have gotten more and more structured.
Mm-hmm. And the lives of their parents, for that matter.
Yeah.
The lives of everyone.
We're highly scheduled.
We are very scheduled, very overscheduled, no question about it.
Yeah. What can we learn from the playfulness we see in animals?
I think we can learn a lot. I mean, first of all, we know that nature doesn't put in a lot of behavior that isn't pretty necessary. And nature has provided an extended period of youth just dedicated to play. So there is something in, you know, evolution that says this is really important. And we know that exuberant play is very important in developing the brain, developing the central nervous system, setting down the beginnings of social play and social understanding, cognition. So from any number of points of view, play is incredibly important. And the very fact that, you know, all mammals have a lot of time in their youth that they dedicate to that says that it is an important behavior.
Mm. And the quality of playfulness has got to be important, too. I mean, one can do some recreation and paint by numbers, but it's not the same as you said a moment ago, glumping.
No, I mean, no. I think painting by numbers is perhaps the 180 off of glumping. You know, first of all, it's predictable. Secondly, somebody else is telling you what colors to use and
yeah.
what lines to use and what instrument to use. Whereas galumphing play means, by definition, it's inventive. It's using your imagination. It's flailing about. It's using a lot of energy. It's doing anything but painting between the lines.
Yeah, yeah. I have a cat, and his name is Frisbee, and he came with that name from the shelter. And it was clear why he was named that. And, you know, he's an older cat now, but he continues to play. And he's
mm-hmm.
he's been the healthiest, most active, most curious, most wonderful cat. And I think it is because of his, you know, it seems that there is a joy in his play.
Yeah, so and it's interesting, you know, I mean, Margaret Mead said she was fascinated by the idea of the kind of person who could maintain that childlike wonder and that childlike sense of play. And I think that that's an incredibly important attribute that you see, for example, in a lot of scientists, that constant playing with ideas of kind of trying new things out, experimenting, of being engaged, actively engaged with the world, asking questions, and delighting in trying to find the answers.
Hmm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with our first caller this afternoon on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. I have a number of questions, but you're talking about exuberance, and I'm just wondering, I know that you've also written on bipolarism and mania and depression, so I'm wondering when, you know, exuberance can go beyond a very healthy state to one of mania. I read a book on bipolarism, and it says that, you know, a person who's manic needs to actually identify that before, maybe in the hypomanic stage, before they get really manic, because mm-hmm. if they do, then there's no one that will convince them that they're beyond the healthy point. And I'm also interested in, maybe you're talking about the latest medications for bipolarism and whether they're as easy to find one that works then for the SSRIs for depression. And then also, you said you were going to talk about creativity, and I was wondering, you know, what is that line, or is there a line, do you think, between creativity and madness, and linguistic abilities and poetry? You know, that so much poetry is about love, for example. And where does, you know, where is that positive, and where does that, you know, even go beyond? I mean, it makes great poetry, but perhaps in people's lives it may not be a positive aspect.
Right. Well, I spend quite a bit of time in my book talking about the continuum between exuberance and mild manic states and the importance of making the distinction that exuberance is basically a highly adaptive, very healthy state.
Right.
There's no question that in some people, many people who have bipolar illness have an underlying exuberant temperament, and that they begin to get more and more and more exuberant and then risk getting dangerously out of control. And so I certainly discuss that kind of overlap between the mild manic states and mania on the one end and exuberance on the other end. And, you know, you distinguish in a lot of ways, but basically mania is a very pathological state, potentially dangerous and certainly destructive state. But it is certainly true, as you say, that in the early stages of mania, it's important to be aware that it's possibly early mania because people feel great. And so even though they're going on and becoming quite ill, their judgment is impaired because their feeling state is that they feel terrific. And that is a notoriously difficult clinical situation to try and get somebody into treatment who's becoming manic because they do feel so exuberant. And in terms of treatment, there are lots of treatments out there now, many medications. Lithium, of course, is sort of still the gold standard, but there are many anticonvulsant medications, antipsychotic medications, antidepressants. So there's the great thing about bipolar illness in this day and age as opposed to even 10 years ago is that there are a lot of good treatments out there.
And
also psychotherapy, and psychotherapy is very important in conjunction with medication.
Okay, so what about, brain chemistry in terms of, with children, one might want to have them live in a positive environment and a positive lifestyle that's not too stressful or, that kind of thing, or parents aren't workaholics or, they get exposure to the environment. I'm just wondering, if you could talk something about, normal brain chemistry and, or, within a normal range, and then, what happens when it goes off. And how we can, stimulate positive, brain chemistry, but then some people, you can't just say, you need to do a little yoga or, take a walk in nature or listen to some music. How is that different between those who can, rationally decide, I'm going to improve my state of mind by doing a few restful things, positive things for a few days, and those who...
Well, there's a difference between doing a few positive things to relax and exuberance. Exuberance is not necessarily a relaxed state by any stretch of the imagination. It's a high-energy state, and generally when you're talking about a relaxed state, you're not talking so much about high energy. So that generally, if you're talking about how can people build in more exuberance into their lives, I think one thing people can do is to try and get some time where life is not so structured. And that, I know that's easier said than done, but it's, I think, very, very important. It's very important, certainly, to a creative life, to a creative mind, to have free time and to do things that are out in nature, because we know from the literature, for example, that one of the most consistent triggers of exuberant states is nature itself. Mm-hmm. And that it's important to get out into nature. And I think we all kind of know that instinctively, but we don't tend to act on it very much. Also music, of course. Music and dance are being around other people who are exuberant, populating your life, your friendships, with one or two people who are exuberant by nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I was saying is that possibly doing some of these things that are considered relaxing might, remove some sense of depression or negativity, and then that would allow perhaps an exuberant state to come out. But I was wondering if you could talk more about creativity then and the line between, creativity and going off the scale.
Well, there are a lot of studies of the relationship between creativity, for example, and mood disorders, bipolar illness, and depression, and a large number of studies showing that there is an increased rate of depression and bipolar illness in people who are very creative. Obviously, most people who are creative don't have mood disorders, and most people who have mood disorders aren't creative, but there is a disproportionate rate of history of depression, mania, hypomania in people who are highly creative. So that's been known for quite a while. We also know that if you create an exuberant state or a positive mood state in people, they are more likely to come up with imaginative responses on structured tests.
Hmm.
I want to thank the listener for her call, and we're going to go and talk with another listener, also in Champaign, line two. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. I am an exuberant person, a joyful person. But anyway, I wanted to ask you two questions. I don't know. I haven't read the book, by the way. Do pets make one more exuberant? You've alluded to that. Do holidays make one more exuberant without being manic depressive? If you want me to, I'll stay on the line, and if you don't, I'll hang up.
Well, why don't you stay on the line?
Okay.
The literature that I'm aware of, at least with pets, tends to be around their relaxing effect, their effect on blood pressure. They certainly seem to have a good effect on health.
Uh-huh.
And on mental health.
Okay.
I think, you know, when you're talking about your cat bounding about, there's no question that bounding about animals can raise one's mood temporarily. Moods are contagious, and exuberant moods are contagious. So if you see your cat running off after something or being playful, it brings out, it triggers an intrinsic playful response and joyous response, however fleetingly and however mild, in most people. I mean, that doesn't always happen, but it certainly often happens.
How about holidays?
Well, I think one person's great holidays or another person's bad holidays.
Uh-huh.
You know, it depends. I mean, I think if you have a great relationship with your family and you have a history of having very wonderful memories of good holidays with your family, then of course that's going to, you know, be very likely. I don't know if so much making somebody exuberant as being a happy occasion, and exuberance and happiness are different things. A lot of people have those kinds of experiences. A lot of people don't have those kinds of experiences. They have more conflicted or difficult experiences.
I have one comment, then I will shut up. In hospice, I noticed that we have lots and lots of deaths during holidays because you build up to that point, and then suddenly it's over and it's done. And anyway, can you comment about that, or have you done so in your book?
Well, I certainly comment on the relationship between extremely high moods and exuberant states and depression, because they can be the flip side of one another. And people who have very intense moods can sometimes go either way. They can go and be high and exuberant and joyful and veer off into mania on occasions. And that same person may be more vulnerable to despair and depression.
Hmm. That reminds me, going back to Theodore Roosevelt, someone who knew him said, and you quote them in your book, life for Roosevelt was the unpacking of endless Christmas stockings.
Mm-hmm.
Yet at the same time, when death touched his life, when his father died, then the deaths of a wife and mother, his grief was intense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think his temperament affected how he experienced grief?
I think very much so. And I think that, I mean, one of the people that I write about is Virginia Woolf and also Robert Louis Stevenson, who both were ebullient life enhancers. They were known by their friends as life enhancers. They brought vitality to every situation in which they found themselves. And yet both of them also were subject to profound depression and despair. And one of the things that's very interesting is why are some people wired in such a way that they have very intense responses of joy, that they can feel an intensity of joy that other people can only imagine. But likewise, they might veer off in the opposite direction into really profound despondency. And I think that that's one of the things that psychology is grappling with. I mean, I think this modern psychology is doing very, very interesting things and in looking at emotions and intense emotions as well.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is psychologist Kay Redfield Jamison. Her latest book is Exuberance, The Passion for Life. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. We've said a couple of times here this afternoon already that exuberance is contagious.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, I think most moods are contagious. I mean, part of why you exist if you're a mood is to transmit yourself to other people or other animals, not just humans. So that if you're a herd animal and there is in your environment a threat, for example, some sort of danger, whether it's your cow and there's a snake or whatever it is, it's very important that that danger be quickly transmitted to the other animals. And so if the animal that responds first and most intensely to that threat sets up a body language that then transmits that fear and that anxiety to the rest of the animals so that they can disperse, they can run, they can do whatever it is that they have to do. Likewise, with joy, if you think about being around an athlete who's just, you know, won an event or someone who is in a crowd situation at the end of World War II, for example, those great celebrations at the end of the war, or when the moon landing, there is a collective relief that the danger is past, and there's also a sense that there is energy and time to try something new. There's time for opportunity. So if you think about somebody waving up their arms and throwing their arms up wide, that will transmit itself to the next person. And we know that from, you know, an awful lot of studies that moods do transmit themselves. Mm-hmm. If you're around somebody who's depressed, that mood will to some extent transmit itself to whoever is sitting next to that person who's depressed. It's in our nature, we are social animals, and it's in our nature to have our moods be social.
Yeah. So these moods and how we communicate them to one another are a way of keeping the collective healthy.
Absolutely. And you know, it's, for example, with dance or music, what you're doing is when you have a common rhythm that is excited and high energy, that is arousing. It is both reflecting sometimes the mood, but it transmits a mood and it creates a mood. And it creates a unified mood so that, you know, if everybody's listening to a Handel, a great Handel aria that is joyous by nature, it will create in the audience a kind of a collective mood of joy.
Hmm. Also, though, you know, in the arts, when something moves us because it is very sad, there is tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
We can experience something similar when that particular piece wraps up, when we leave the theater, or when we, you know what I'm saying?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, it's the idea of the catharsis,
right?
The cleansing,
the catharsis, and the idea of having created for a while a set of feelings and emotions that are profound or disturbing, resolved, unresolved, but it is the creation of intense mood.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller on line one. No, I'm sorry, we lost that listener on a cell phone. Maybe they'll call us back. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You know, we talked about children earlier briefly, and play, and the school environment and structure. You know, here is another area of life where we're scaling back, and that is the arts.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very interesting when you were right when you're telling us in exuberance about going to see a stage play, a musical,
mm-hmm.
Barnum.
Right, right.
Tell us about that experience and your conversations with one of the stars of the show.
Right. Well, I was teaching at UCLA at the time. I was an assistant professor in the psychiatry department, and I was director of the Mood Disorders Clinic. And I was finding, like I think many of my colleagues, that it's a lot easier to teach about depression than it is to teach about high mood and mild mania and exuberance. And I happened to go see Jim Dale, the English actor, in Barnum, and he played the lead character. And I wrote to him, and I said, I explained my problem to him, a teaching problem, that I really wanted to find a way of conveying high moods and high intensity moods. And he was kind enough to sit down with me for quite a while and talk to me about how important it was, the speed of movement, the movement of the arms and legs, the dancing, the simultaneous use of color and music and action. And from that point on, when I was teaching about mania, I used music as part of the way of inducing high mood, not mania per se, of course, but of inducing high mood. So I used a couple of cuts from the Barnum album to teach residents and medical students about what it was when you're talking about exhilaration, when you're talking about a speeded up state, what is it that you mean? And I found that, music and dance were the things that could really convey that, particularly music, far more than anything else. It was a very helpful exercise, and Mr. Dale was incredibly generous with his time and ideas.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I was thinking about yesterday when I was thinking about, you know, a musical bridge to get us from the newscast into our discussion this afternoon.
That was a great bridge, by the way.
Was I was thinking about, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Barbara Streisand did a recording of A Minute Waltz, where she has to, you know, the movement is just, she can hardly keep her breath.
I don't know that.
And it's a wonderful kind of, it's very exuberant, but yet it's also, it also kind of gets across the idea of, I can hardly do this.
Right.
Movement is important. I want to get back to that idea here in a moment. But in terms of easier to teach, how to recognize depression than a manic state, is it also true? Would it be also true to say that it is easier to deflate exuberance rather than to dispel depression?
I think probably so, or at least to do so in the short term, that almost everyone I interviewed, a lot of people for this book who were highly exuberant and who talked about the role of exuberance in their professional lives and in their personal lives, and almost to the person, people talked about how easy it was to mock exuberance. It is a larger-than-life emotion. And people are very vulnerable. It's the sort of the Carl Sagan effect. And, you know, he was somebody who was a great teacher of astronomy and cosmology, but he never outlived his, you know, his expression about billions and billions of stars, because he was such an enthusiast, and, you know, his arms were waving, and he was all caught up in everything. And there is that element of slightly ridiculous. And one of the reasons I talked about some of the animals that are used to portray exuberance in children's stories was exactly that effect, that Tigger, for example, or Toad in Wind in the Willows are faintly ridiculous, if not overtly ridiculous, characters. And that's the way the author portrays them, and it is in that way that the other animals respond to them. And that makes them very vulnerable to having their exuberance, you know, squashed for a bit. But it's also in the nature of exuberance to be pretty irrepressible. So even though somebody maybe gets deflated temporarily, there is a tendency for them to bound back eventually.
I guess it's, you know, I think it's David Letterman. Every once in a while, he'll refer to someone as perky.
Right.
And, you know, he means it as kind of like, you're over the top, hon.
Perky. And he also means it as vapid. There's a vapid quality to that, yes.
Yeah, same thing. Back to the idea of movement and how important it is in our lives. And we know that exercise is important to our well-being. But, you know, we get to a certain point in our life when we talk about exercise and we've forgotten the play. We treat it as work.
Right.
And not as play. I wonder if that's one of the reasons.
Well, that's part of it, because, I mean, if you look at the nature of most people's exercise, it's pretty boring stuff, right? I mean, a treadmaster is not galumphing. It's not like you're running through the woods and tripping over logs, is it? I mean, you're on this, and I say this as somebody who uses a Treadmaster. There's nothing particularly interesting about it. You're not taking any risks. You're not going anywhere that you weren't planning to go, which is to say nowhere. And it's not the same as play. Exercise is very different. Exercise is regimented. It's predictable. It's usually indoors. Not always, but usually. I mean, it's the difference between, I think, really being actively engaged in a sport that you love, or that you're passionate about, that you put, you know, body English into, as opposed to, you know, getting on a bicycle in a gym.
Yeah. Well, there's a great difference when the weather is bad between doing your walk in a park, you know, when the weather's good, and then having to turn to a mall or or a track somewhere.
At least.
yeah. I guess it, you know, exercise is, again, you know, like the idea of paint by numbers.
Right. It's completely predictable. I mean, it doesn't mean it's not good for you, because it obviously is good for you.
Right.
It's good for your brain.
Don't throw this Stairmaster away or whatever.
No. I mean, it's very important to your mental being, your brain, your cognitive functioning, to your body, to your cardiac functioning. I mean, it's very healthy stuff to do, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's riveting.
Yeah. In our culture, do you think that we get a signal somewhere along the line that play is not vital, that it's not serious, that one gets to a point in life and then it's time to be serious?
Yes, and I think that to some extent is a natural, you know, it's a natural reaction to life itself. In other words, the time that's established for play, and for very exuberant play in young animals, is a time in which their parents are providing food for them, providing safety for them, providing shelter for them. And at some point, and so that gives them the leisure, as it were, to be able to galump. But when they themselves have to then go reproduce, mate, provide structure and food for the next generation, they simply haven't the same kind of time to gamble about that they did when they were young. And so I think it's inevitable that a certain amount of exuberant energy passes with time. The question is, why is it in some people that high exuberant state maintains? And why is it that we don't value it more? And what is it that one can do to try and hold on to it? Because I do think it's not just icing on the cake. Exuberance is, I think, a tremendously important part. For example, I write a lot about scientists because I think that in that kind of questing for new knowledge, and, of course, it's also true for, you know, many other professions and the arts as well. But to have that kind of high energy, that kind of constant curiosity and engagement with the world is a wonderful thing. Not everybody has it, but it's wonderful when it does exist.
Well, you know, that kind of exuberance, playfulness can lead us to wonderful discoveries.
For sure, and I think it frequently does.
Yeah, well, maybe you'd talk with us a little bit about Wilson Bentley.
Yes, the Snowflake Bentley, who was a Vermont farmer, and an uneducated man, who was the first person who really was able to photograph snowflakes. And he just had a lifelong passion. It was a consuming passion for him to photograph snowflakes, to try and capture some of the beauty that he saw. And he was somebody who was so exuberant about the beauty that he wanted to share it with everybody else. And his notion of sharing it was to write about it, to talk about it, and to photograph it. And if you read his scientific writings about snowflakes, it's just his enthusiasm bounces off the pages. You just are enraptured with this man and with his love of these crystals. And I think he's a great example of many scientists and many people who pursue knowledge and adventure through, like, very adverse situations. I mean, he used to stand out winter after winter in the Vermont freezing cold in order to capture these just tiny bits of nature and record them, because he was so concerned that people wouldn't be able to see their beauty if he didn't do it.
Mm. His exuberance then was directed inward and outward.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
And when we go back and think about John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt, and I think this is something you point to in the book as well, is that they are different kinds of exuberant personalities.
Yes, I mean, some people, for example, John Muir, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt never met a stranger. I mean, he clearly loved being around crowds of people, although he certainly very much enjoyed his own company in reading, because he'd read a book, almost a book a day. But they were very different sorts of men. They had very different backgrounds. Unlike Teddy Roosevelt, John Muir had a very unhappy childhood. He was an immigrant Scot. He was someone who really wanted to live in the woods and be in the woods, whereas Roosevelt obviously was a man of cities, ultimately. And yet they both shared this sense that they couldn't stand for the wilderness to be violated. They loved it so much that they wanted to preserve it. And their interaction saved the Yosemite. And their passion for saving the lands was, of course, extremely important in saving as much of the American wilderness as the two of them did save.
Mm. Going back to childhood, getting from childhood to maturity, you write about children's literature in this book, mm-hmm. Exuberance, and in a chapter called The Glowing Hours. And stories really help guide us over this passage that can be pretty rough. How have the best writers of children's literature, from your point of view, dealt with this passage? Who are the writers that you would recommend? We had that first call this afternoon from a woman who was concerned about one of the questions that she raised, among all the questions that she raised, was, you know, what can we do to foster passion and joyfulness in our children?
Right. Well, there's so many great writers. I mean, James Barry, Kenneth Graham, E.B. White, Walter R. Brooks, Louisa May Alcott, I mean, Frank Baum. People who've written about so many different aspects of childhood in such remarkable ways. And I think that there's a tendency to forget what brilliant writers they really are. You know, we tend to think of the great novelists as being people who write for adults, and yet these people create imagined worlds. And in those imagined worlds, I think one of the things that's clear is that they put a premium on the intense emotions of all kinds, the kinds of emotional changes that children go through, and that children are going to be exposed to a wide variety of temperaments. They're going to have friends who are, you know, on the depressed side or on the anxious side or introverted. They're going to have friends who are extroverted, exuberant by nature. And the question is what do you do with all the different kinds of temperaments? And my argument would be is that, you know, one of our great, great advantages as a species is that we have such a wide variety of temperaments, that there's such diversity and there's such a richness. And, you know, we talk a lot about diversity of race and diversity of ethnic backgrounds and diversity of religion and being tolerant. But what we don't talk about very much is how important it is to be tolerant of a diversity of temperaments. You know, that the advantages of being introverted and hesitant are huge. They're huge to the individual, but particularly to the species. The advantages of exuberance. I focus on exuberance because I think exuberance doesn't get taken seriously enough. It doesn't have the kind of gravitas that depression and tragedy and suffering have. And yet I think it's as important to furthering knowledge and understanding and helping us adapt. And resilience. I mean, I write quite a lot about resilience. And how is it that, I mean, all of us are going to have tragedies and losses and death or madness or whatever in our lives. And the question is, how do you deal with it? What gives you the strength to carry on, to bound back? And an exuberant temperament will give some people that capacity in, you know, full measure. And for other people, it will take longer to come back. But that capacity to rebound is a lot of what defines us as humans.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned Frank Baum and Dorothy, you know, of Oz.
Right, and all the wild
Fabulous.
Characters. Of,
yeah.
And, you know, again, you know, you think
right.
It's a world populated with different temperaments, different imaginations, some heavy on heart, some heavy on brain, you know, and some heavy on courage and some not so. And all the little animals and little munchkins and, you know, the variety of lands. It's just this imaginative territory that won't stop. Or the, you know, the wild wood of The Wind in the Willows, you know, or Peter Pan, you know, these, or Treasure Island. I mean, I think Stevenson, you know, to me, I suppose I go back time and again to Robert Louis Stevenson, for a lot for his nonfiction writing, actually, but for his fiction writing as well, because it's just so, it's so true of human nature. It's just remarkably so. He's writing about children, and he captures that incredible imagination of childhood, but he also, in his writings for adults, his nonfiction writings, his ability to portray that ongoing joy for life is remarkable, and likewise the tragedy of life.
Mm. From Tigger to Eeyore.
From Tigger to Eeyore, that's right, or Rabbit, or, you know, yeah. I mean, it's a wide variety, and it's that which makes everything interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's been good galumphing with you this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Kay Redfield Jamison has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. And to Kay and all our listeners this afternoon, happy galumphing. Kay Redfield Jamison's latest book is Exuberance, The Passion for Life. The publisher is Alfred Knopf. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the wheat pit finished the day mixed. The nearby December contract was a penny higher at the end of the day, with a 313 high, a low at 308, and a settlement price there at 312. Once again, that December wheat contract finished the day one higher. March futures up a penny and a half, a high today of 323 and three quarters, low at 319 and one quarter, and a settlement price at 323 and a quarter. May contract in the wheat pit, 328, the high, the low at 324, settlement price there, 326 and three quarters. They were up three quarters for the day. And the July futures, 331 the high, the low at 327, settlement price at 328 and three quarters. They were down a quarter of a cent. September wheat unchanged at the end of this trading day, 336 the high, the low at 335. Finished Wednesday afternoon at 335, down on that low, unchanged for the September wheat. From the corn pit, futures trading mostly higher today after that huge 11.6 billion bushel crop estimate made by USDA yesterday morning at 7:30 a.m. that rather took the trade by surprise, but they absorbed it extraordinarily well. I spoke with Daryl Good this morning about 9 o'clock about that particular trade, and you can hear the bean portion of that interview today, the corn portion of that interview tomorrow on the Closing Market Report. If you can't wait, just go to our website, and you can hear the whole 15-minute interview now at will.uiuc.edu. By the way, cruise down to the bottom of that page and you'll find a place to subscribe to the WILL AM 580 Ag newsletter. We send out a newsletter every weekend, and on weeks when there are important events, we'll send out updates midweek. We did that yesterday. If you sign up now, I'll send you yesterday's update so you can all get all the information that we have been able to obtain, not only from our analysts, but also from USDA on yesterday's crop reports. Now December futures in the corn pit, 205 and three quarters the high today, the low at 202 and a quarter, settlement price at 205 and a quarter. They were up 2 3/4 on fund buying day. Have not yet heard whether that fund buying was replacing some of the shorts or whether it was new buying. March corn, 216 the high, the low at 212 and three quarters, settlement price at 215 and three quarters, up 2.5. We'll ask Paul Cooley that question this afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock during the Closing Market Report. 223 and a quarter, the high today in the May corn, the low at 220 and a quarter, settlement price at 223. They were up 2 1/4 for the day. July futures, 229 and three quarters high, low at 226 and three quarters, settled 229 and a half, up 2.5 cents. And the September contract, 236 the high, the low at 233 and a quarter. They settled at 235 and they were up 2 cents for the day. December for next year, 244 and three quarters the high, the low at 241 and a quarter. Settlement price at 244 and a quarter. Down on the low, or rather 244 and a quarter, and they finished 2 higher for the day. Dease oats now, 145 and a quarter the high, the low at 142. Settlement price 143 and three quarters, up a quarter in the March oats. A 151 high, low at 149, settled 150 and a half. They were up a half cent. From the soy complex, bean futures lower for the day, but not sharply lower as they were yesterday after seeing that 405 million bushel carryout for next fall. That pushed the price of beans sharply lower yesterday. Today, they're down about 3.5 to 5 cents. November contract off 3.5, in fact, with the settlement price at 509.5, the high there 513.5, and the low at 507. January soybeans 521, the high, the low at 514, settlement price at 517.25. They were off 14, or rather off 4.5. And the March beans a 528 high, low at 521, settled 523.5, down 4.5 cents. And the May contract a 536 high, low at 528.5, settlement price there at 530.75, down 5.25. July soybeans 544, the high, the low at 536, the settlement price at 537.75, down 6, and the August off 4 at 540 today. October bean meal 153.90, the high, the low at 156, rather at 150.60, settled 151.20, they were down 210, and December bean meal 155.80, the high, the low at 152.60, settled 152.90, and they were off 250. December bean oil 19.95, the high, low at 1950, settled 1990, up a dime. And the October, rather December bean oil 2020, the high, the low at 1950, settled 2005, and they were up 7 cents for the day. That's a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. Now here with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. Feeder cattle and live cattle finished lower today, while lean hogs and February bellies were on the upside. October feeder cattle, today's high 114.20, the low 113.85, the settlement 114.10, that down 15. November 112.90, the high 112.25, the low, the settlement 112.42.5, that down 57.5. January feeder cattle 109.65, the high 109 even, the low 109.50, the settlement, that down 20. October live cattle 86.40, the high 85.65, the low 86.05, the settlement, that down 72.5. December 88.50, the high 87.85, the low 88.35, the final price, that down 37.5. October lean hog 72.05, the high 71.40, the low 71.95, the settlement, that up a quarter. December lean hog 64.80. December lean hogs, the high price 64.80, the low 63.50, the settlement 64.67.5, that up 37.5. February 64.75, the high 63.30, the low, the settlement for February lean hogs 64.67.5, that finishing up 62.5. April lean hogs 62.80, the high 61.35, the low 62.70, the settlement, that up 72.5. February pork bellies 94.65, the high, the low 93.15, the settlement 94.30, that up 10. The Dow is off 83 points at 99.94, the NASDAQ down 5 at 19.21, and the S&P 500 down 9 points at 11.13.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company, ADM. The nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's